Okay. Welcome, everybody. Thank you so much for joining us here in the Todotnik platform. I'm really excited and so honored to welcome Dunya, who's going to be sharing with us today about emotional fluency. So today, the discussion will be about the relationship between our emotional world and the revelation of the essential self. And we'll be invited to explore a language of emotions, develop skills and emotional fluency that can benefit all of our relationships, and to learn some practices to integrate these as a pathway to access the highest spiritual truths. So I'm very much looking forward to this. And now for a small bit of info, a bio about Tanya. She, Tanya Rico, she holds a master's degree in counselor education and as a specialist degree in couples and family therapy. Her clinical experience includes trauma-informed care, women's holistic mental health, and relationship counseling. Tanya aims to empower individuals and relationships to thrive with deep spiritual principles at the core of transformational experiences. In addition to traditional modalities, Dunya is passionate about customizing therapeutic tools that incorporate devotional principles and practices as means of reconnecting with our essential nature. She's a mother, a traveling kirtaniya, and an educator on topics of personal and relationship wellness. So, thank you so much. And I came to know of you mostly from the podcast that you had with Swami Padmanabha on the Free Radical podcast. And I've been looking forward to having more contact with you since then. So, thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you so much for having me. I feel very grateful to be welcomed into this beautiful community. And I've seen you around when you come to programs here in Alachua, and I always appreciate your questions and your dialogue with Swami Padmanabha. I really I love to hear your thoughts and yeah, looking forward to spending more time together. All right, so we can just begin kind of offering gratitude to our teachers, to our gurus who have illuminated the path so that we may humbly place one foot in front of the other and try and make our way home. Om Akyanati Mirandasya Akyananjana Om Vishvadaya Krishna Prasthavatane Shrimati Bhakti Vedanta Swami Namah Namaste Saraswati Devi Gauravani Pracharine Nirvishesha Shunyavadi Paschatyadeshatayine Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhara Shivasadi Gaurabhaktavinoda Vrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare. So I'm feeling very grateful to be here with you and to be engaging in dialogue about this topic. I think that it's a topic of personal interest. It's been a topic of professional interest, and I think that in the context of our current devotional community, I think that it's very relevant. I think that it's something that's been necessary to talk about, to take a look at, to explore. And I also want to say that, as much as we feel like there may be a dearth of this or a need of this in our devotional community, it's been my experience, living and working outside of the community, that it's also very necessary outside. It's not like places are, the technology out in the world is very much still kind of catching up with the emotional world and the way that neuroscience is developing and, learning about, for example, like attachment theory and All of that has happened relatively recently. So I want to say that, I feel like there's a big movement, even kind of globally, that's really asking us to pay attention to the emotional world and take it seriously. And I feel that, like anything, there's a way in which topics of emotions and the emotional world and, even self-improvement or spiritual life can quickly become commodified because it's the nature of, living in the modern world in a capitalistic society and consumer culture and all that. So I think that it's important in a spiritual community to ground it in spiritual principles because then it can start to kind of float off into this ungrounded place, which I think is what people sense might be a danger of the emotional world. I think that many spiritual practitioners, when they say the people that approach, Krishna consciousness, it's like, who's looking for money? Who's in distress? Who might just have some passing curiosity? Who might be a sincere seeker? The people that are suffering, I think that in generations past, it might have been a different kind of suffering. I think now the suffering is very clearly emotional suffering. People are suffering from depression and anxiety at unprecedented rates. All kinds of diagnoses are going up. The tendency to diagnose is going up. So I think, for all of these reasons, there's like big kind of flashing lights around, like we need to be able to talk about this. And, in addition to that, I think that in order to have a complete, comprehensive, well-integrated spiritual life, we need to be able to use the technology of emotions, because that's really what it is. It's a tool to use a technology of emotions as a way of deepening our spiritual life, of deepening our bonds to other spiritual practitioners, everybody actually, a way of connecting and having a deep, meaningful relationship with anybody that we interact with, and ultimately also self-understanding. And I think that it's a tool that's there with that purpose. I think that Krishna created us with a very clear idea that we needed all the tools that we've been given to be able to do the job properly. So what we're going to focus on today is mostly that, using the tools of emotions and how it relates to our spiritual life. But I did kind of want to put it into context a little bit, just kind of historically and societally, to say, this is the time and space that we're moving in as we're, learning about emotions and having conversations. And I also very much encourage, if anyone has a question or a comment, some feedback, some experience, these conversations are so much more rich when we interact with one another and we get to practice what we're talking about. I'm very much a student of this, much more than I'm a teacher. So I wanted also to preface that is to say, I'm learning and I'm sharing what I learned because I find it to be very valuable. I think I'll be a lifelong student of this because I find it fascinating, I find it useful, and I think that it's necessary. So I kind of wanted to just plant a little bit of a kind of a North Star, something to orient us. And it was this beautiful verse, and kind of preparing this, I was looking for verses that mention the word emotion. And, in our literature, our bhakti literature, like in the Gita or in the Srimad Bhagavatam or in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, you'll see the word emotion and it's usually, cognate with the word bhava, right? But I found this beautiful verse that I saw it and just like the visual of it. And the meaning of it just really hit home as like, yeah, this is what we're trying to understand, or this is what we're trying to approach, with our humble, humble devotion here. So it's the Sisi Madhyalila. So it's verse 174 in chapter 13. It says, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's body appeared like a transcendental Himalayan mountain, bearing ecstatic emotional flower trees, all of them blooming. Ecstatic emotional flower trees, all of them blooming. And I just thought, man, that's where it's at. That's really where it's at. That's what we want. We want ecstatic emotional flower trees, all of them blooming. So all of them blooming, when I read that, and there's not a purport given in Srila Prabhupada's CC, but when I think about all of them blooming, I just think how fluid Mahaprabhu's example of emotions really is, how he is able to, almost suddenly go from one emotion to the next. Obviously, this is in the context of transcendent emotion. These are all perfectly pure. It's the highest caliber expression of the emotional world in a spiritual sense. And he's able to move from one emotion to the other with such fluidity. It's so fluid that it actually catches others off guard. And it's very shocking, actually, that it's so fluid. And I think that there's something to this. I think that there's something to this. It's not something that we can imitate, but I think that it's something that is, we're supposed to kind of understand analogously, that fluidity in the emotional world speaks to health. It speaks to contact. It speaks to being in the present moment and really understanding ourselves properly. And I feel like it also speaks to courage. It means that I'm brave enough and I have the capacity, I have trust in the experience enough that I'm going to these places emotionally knowing that I'm able to handle them, I'm able to digest them. And there's a it actually takes quite a lot in the human experience to get to a place where you feel comfortable, confident, safe, going to, many different emotional places. But I just wanted to kind of plant that verse as our guiding light, because that's really what we're trying to get to. We're not just studying emotions for emotion's sake. We're actually doing this because we believe that there is some way in which we relate with Radha Krishna on an emotional level in a pure way. And I think that that's, it's important. So, kind of getting down into how we experience emotions, for us, emotions are like it's like the energetic fuel of the subtle body. We know that we come with, certain material machinery in this life, and part of it is the gross body, all my five senses that I use to interact with the world, or, they'll say like the five senses in the mind is a way of interacting with the world interacting with me. It's like the interface that I use to be able to contact matter, because I'm not actually made of matter. I'm the spirit soul. So these are tools so that I'm able to interface with the environment. And that includes the subtle body, which includes the mind. So when we talk about emotions, emotions are basically energy. It's just energy. And you can feel the energy. When you get angry, it suddenly charges you up. It's very hard to be like sleepy and angry at the same time, or excited and sleepy at this, because it has like so much energy. And so we can consider it a tool that's been gifted to us by Krishna in order to navigate our human experience. So in that sense, if we kind of channel that as like, okay, this is what is going to be our definition of emotions, then immediately we can start to invoke gratitude, because it's a gift, right? It's something that's a tool that we're meant to use also. Tool meaning utility. There's something that I'm supposed to do with it. It's not just a burden. So it's something that is actually useful. And that the idea, the principle of Yukta Vairagya is means I am in charge of making it useful. Something, Prabhupada always gives the example of like the microphone. The microphone is just kind of a microphone. It's inert and you can kind of use it for whatever. But with your consciousness, you transform what that microphone means, what that is by its use. And so I feel like the emotions are the same way. And there's a little bit of a tricky element to it, because we sometimes feel like our emotions are in charge of us, like they're using us. We're the microphone and the emotions are speaking through us. And I think that that's an important distinction to make, which is, ontologically, in terms of hierarchy, right? There's the senses, there's the mind, there's the intelligence, there's the self. So that self, we're actually the ones who are supposed to be kind of using these tools. And having the element of gratitude, I think, really allows us to kind of enter into a friendly relationship with our emotions, even the emotions that maybe we might have categorized in some ways like negative, unhelpful, detrimental, so on. And we'll get to that in a second, actually. So the five senses and the mind are kind of considered to be, our tools for navigating the human experience. And when we read in Sanskrit and verses in our literature, we read that heart and mind are kind of used interchangeably, right? Mana is considered like the mind, but it's also considered like the heart, the essence, the feeling of someone, not in the bhava feeling way, like in terms of mood, but in the terms of like selfhood, understanding yourself, understanding who you are, how you're feeling. That is usually mind and heart are used a little bit interchangeably. It's not a direct translation. It seems like mana is kind of like a blend of both in some way. And I think that this dichotomy that we've created in our modern world of the mind and the heart, that's a it's a product of rationalism, basically. right? Where your brain is your analytic self, your heart is your emotional self, and one is clearly kind of denoted as being superior. And I think that that is something that kind of causes us to disembody, right? Because the emotional world is that connection between the mind and the body, the mind and the gut. And a lot of harm comes from that, actually. A lot of harm comes from that because we start floating into this sort of impersonal intellectual space where we're in a space of analysis and not embodiment. And that's really dangerous, actually. It's dangerous for our bodies and it's really dangerous for our relationships because we're simultaneously like in something but not truly present in it. So our emotions also help us make sense of incoming data, right? Just like any of our other senses. I see something and I can recognize, is this dangerous? Is this friendly? Is this familiar? Is this not? Is this new? Is this interesting? Is, you know, whatever. Our emotions also help us process incoming data, just like our other senses. And actually, neuroscientists have found that when people have parts of their brains that are damaged that affect their emotions, you know, part of their limbic system or so on, where they've had some sort of brain trauma and they're not able to process emotions, they have a super hard time with things like basic decision making, like, you know, what restaurant do you want to eat at? Or what place would you like to visit? Or what would you like to do today? And it's not that they're confused. Intellectually, they understand what you're saying. They understand the options. It's not an issue with the information. They just don't care. And because they don't care, they're incapable of making decisions. So feeling emotions, they don't just, you know, give us a state of mood or a reaction in this kind of bulk emotional way, they actually help us in a very practical way. We are meant to use our emotions to even express our preferences, to express our selfhood, actually, because how I feel is going to be a reflection, many ways, of who I am or what I've been through. So, you know, these people were just like not able to make a decision. So it just goes to show how important it is to not try and shun or compartmentalize or get rid of emotions. Because if we get rid of emotions, we think in some way like, oh, things would be easier. If I wasn't so emotional, if I didn't feel this and this and that, things would be easier. But actually, even on a very practical day-to-day way, it would actually be infinitely harder. We wouldn't be able to make basic decisions. So, you know, I wanted to kind of put that in there to show that, you know, that there's an inherent value in the emotions just in our kind of material day-to-day life. We also have a tendency to what researchers call as valence emotions, just like chemically, you know, there's like a valencing of like positive or negative atoms, I guess. I'm obviously not a chemist, but there are certain elements that are valenced as positive or negative. And we tend to do this with emotions, right? So we tend to say, oh, happiness is positive, sadness is negative. Anger is negative. That's a real big one, right? Especially when you hear, you know, people say things like, you know, anger in spiritual life or lust and greed. And, you know, they're negative emotions in the sense that they're undesirable. They cause hindrance in our spiritual life, and then happiness and excitement or surprise or joy or whatever, then those are considered positive. Oh, back to your S's, correct me. Yes, it's electrons. Okay, so I'm not a physicist. And but thank you for the correction. Yeah, so valencing, you know, it creates that positive or negative charge. We tend to do this around emotions. And so what's dangerous about this is that if we start classifying emotions as positive or negative, what we'll naturally want to do is create more of the positive emotions and avoid the negative emotions. And this is really dangerous because, in order to have integrity as a human, we need to be able to experience all the emotions in a way that is digestible. And we also have to create realistic expectations about what the emotional experience is going to be as humans. And that's why our spiritual literature is so important, because when we read the Bhagavad Gita, or we read the Bhagavatam, or any of our spiritual texts, it's implicit and explicit that happiness and suffering are going to be alternating throughout the entirety of our human experience. It's just a part of the system. It's a part of the medicine, actually, of being human. Is having those alternating experiences of happiness and distress that come like the winter and summer seasons. And in order for us to be able to understand the emotional world, if we have that spiritual foundation of like, oh, this is a part of this program, this is a part of this world, the programming is such that I'm experiencing happiness and distress, then I have a better chance of not clinging to the happiness and not clinging to the distress, right? Not creating attachment to one experience or the other. So what's interesting is, researchers have found that when people overfocus on positive emotions, happiness and joy, and all those things, they suffer greatly. We might know this as spiritualists. We might know this from our personal experience. We're trying to create these experiences exclusively creates enormous suffering. And it's because they're actually not meant to be experienced that way. Each emotion itself is programmed in such a way that it has its own nature and its own flow, its own temperature, its own speed, its own pace. And if you try and force it or manipulate it or control it, which is usually coming from a place of fear, lack of trust, then what happens is you're kind of tampering with the medicine of that emotion. You're not allowing that emotion to do what it's meant to do in your psychological experience or in your psycho-spiritual experience. And it's not able to drop in the medicine that it's supposed to drop in. So even things as dark as, there's a beautiful book called The Language of Emotions, and the author says that, she herself struggled with suicidal ideation. And she said that even that has a medicine, right? She explains very clearly, and I mean, I put it as eloquently as her. I know that it's a sensitive topic, but she says very clearly that she knew that something had to die, but it wasn't her. The medicine of those dark thoughts of ending your life is like a big alarm saying something needs to change in a major, drastic way. Something is not okay. Whether I need help, I need support, I need to grieve something, I've been through something traumatic, something is so urgent and something needs to catalyze, something needs to transform, something needs to die and something needs to be reborn. So much that the person will even have those thoughts turned inward toward themselves and it harms the self, harms the body. So that was her personal realization about it. And in reading that, I kind of realized, wow, like, even our darkest emotions have some form of medicine that if we were well supported and were able to interpret things kind of in their purest way, it's really medicinal and it really heals and helps us. So they become tools for us, and we come out the other side evolved and aware and also able to hold space for others. One of the most beautiful things about emotional intelligence and emotional fluency is that in as much as you're able to help yourself and understand yourself, to that extent, you're able to be available to serve and support others. And because we're in this culture of bhakti, where seva is at the heart of what we're doing, it's not just serving the divine couple in whatever humble way we might be able to, it's also serving our fellow spiritual practitioners. And we can only do that to the extent that we're clear and that we're able to use these tools for the good of our relationships as well. So one other advantage of becoming emotionally fluent, right? Being able to contact emotions, describe emotions, feel emotions safely, witness and appreciate other people's emotions is that the more skilled you are at that, the less loud your emotions tend to have to go, right? If you're operating in broad categories of emotions, right, which is usually mad, sad, glad, right? They say those are like the basic ones that people can appreciate in themselves initially. It's like, I'm happy, I'm not happy, and I'm sad. So if you operate in those broad ways, then any other form of emotion is going to get kind of immediately sucked into those categories. And there's going to be like kind of a threshold that you have to reach in order for it to get your attention because all the emotions are being grouped there. So it becomes kind of saturated. So if anything is going to stand out, it has to be very loud. And for many of us, that's been our experience that because we're unfamiliar in the emotional world, there's a feeling of kind of blunted emotions, right? Blunted kind of, we're not so sensitive to understanding ourselves and understanding others. So emotions have to go very hot. They have to run very hot in order to get our attention. And suddenly we're like, wow, that person's so mad. Or, why am I, I can only feel joy if I'm feeling exhilarated. There's like an adrenaline need there, or, I'm feeling a loss. And this is the first time I'm able to understand what it's like for me to truly be sad or to grieve something. So if we're able to be more attuned to our emotions and become more skilled at describing our emotions and languaging our emotions, we're actually able to perceive a greater diversity of emotions and we're able to be more accurate. And this accuracy piece is actually super, super important There's an incredible researcher. Her name is Brené Brown, and she researches shame and resilience. And she's got all kinds of incredible books out there about perfectionism and leadership, so many different topics. But one of the things that she recently did a good amount of research on was emotions. And she has this beautiful book called Atlas of the Heart, where she studies, I think it's like upwards of 80 different emotions. And she really fine-tunes the kind of comparing and contrasting different emotions as a way of broadening our emotional vocabulary. And she was quoting a philosopher. And this philosopher was saying, his name is Wittgenstein, I believe. And he was saying, the quote is great. She says, "The limits of our language, the limits of our language are the limits of our world." Right? To the extent that we're able to describe our experience, that's the extent to which I actually experience the world. And this is really important because one of the things that Brené Brown is talking about is she says that there's something called emotional granularity. That means that you're able to describe things very precisely, and that actually shapes your experience. So one thing is I'm able to describe what's happening to me. And the other side of the coin is that as I'm describing, I'm also creating an experience. I'm also creating a reality. So she uses the distinction, for example, between being overwhelmed and being stressed. She said that she would have a lot of things to do, and she would constantly be kind of repeating to herself this mantra of like, I'm overwhelmed, I'm overwhelmed, I'm so overwhelmed, I'm so overwhelmed. And as she started studying what overwhelm actually is, it means that you've passed the point of functioning, of decision making. The only thing to do when you're feeling overwhelmed is completely shut off. You need to take a break. You can't do anything then. So imagine you telling yourself, I'm overwhelmed, I'm overwhelmed, I'm overwhelmed, I'm overwhelmed. You start creating a reality where your body, right, is responding to your emotions and saying, well, then what we need to do is just shut down. So you start basically making poor decisions or kind of betraying what your body is reading as the medicine. The medicine is you need to stop, you need to back off, and you need to rest, but you're not backing off and you're not resting. So that contradiction between language and experience can start to get really tricky. And that's why it's also important to be very precise with our language, because how we express what we're feeling will have an embodied consequence, right? So she learned to say, well, do I need to stop right now? Like, is the medicine right now to just stop and back off, or am I stressed? Well, if I'm stressed, there are these things that I can do to manage my stress, to change how I'm making this decision, to ask for some support. Stress has a different connotation. So she started changing the way that she spoke to herself and she spoke to others as she was experiencing challenges. She changed her language to I'm stressed, and that actually changed her experience of having to deal with whatever she was dealing with. So I think that part of the self-knowledge that we can take advantage of here is, as I learn what emotions I'm experiencing, I need to simultaneously have language that feels very precise, very accurate in describing what that is. And I think that it's interesting because in our bhakti literature, we'll read words that feel very precise. Like when you hear, for example, Arjuna describing his crisis is the beginning of the Bhagavad Gita. He's describing to Krishna like an emotional experience, a physical experience, a mental experience. He's like describing his thoughts. He's describing how he feels in his body. He's describing his heart, his worries, right? He's describing what the fallout of the relationships from there on, like if we all pass away, he's going to protect the women and then society is going to fall apart. So he's able to use language to convey his experience. And this wasn't in any way incompatible with his dharma. It was a necessary part of his dharma to express the emotions. Now, when Krishna comes in, he's saying, okay, but you're lamenting for something that's not meant to be lamented for, right? The emotions are taking over you, and you're not able to confront what's happening to you emotionally with the tools that I've given you, right? With devotional service, with trust. So the idea is not to basically give the steering wheel over to the emotions and say, now I'm just at the mercy of whatever. It's that we're supposed to be using them simultaneously, like a dual track. And in this sense, I wanted to kind of pivot into how this might relate to our devotional community directly. So in the purport to Bhagavad Gita, chapter 3, text 1, Arjuna says, "O Janardan, O Keshava, why do you urge me to engage in this ghastly warfare if you think that intelligence is better than fruit of work?" And in the purport, Srila Prabhupada, he's saying that, Krishna's elaborately described the constitution of the soul and that we're not meant to confront a crisis and basically seclude ourselves to chant Hare Krishna. He very specifically says that. He says, "Sometimes Krishna consciousness is misunderstood to be inertia. And one with such a misunderstanding often withdraws to a secluded place to become fully Krishna conscious by chanting the holy names of Lord Krishna." Right? And then later on, he says, "Arjuna also thought of Krishna consciousness or buddhi yoga or intelligence in spiritual advancement of knowledge as something like retirement from active life and the practice of penance and austerity at a secluded place. In other words," and this is the part that I highlighted, "he wanted to skillfully avoid the fighting by using Krishna consciousness as an excuse." Which is so great. It's so great that Prabhupada puts it so plainly. And then he says, "But as a sincere student, he placed the matter before his master and questioned Krishna as to his best course of action. In answer, Lord Krishna elaborately explained karma yoga or work in Krishna consciousness." So when we talk about work in Krishna consciousness, right, when we talk about purifying the tools of our work in this world, I don't think that that excludes emotions. I think that that includes emotions. I think that it's very tempting to use Krishna consciousness as an escape hatch to not have to deal with the emotional world, because emotions are difficult. Frankly, because emotions are so much energy. I think that we are afraid of the power in our emotions. And because of that, we tend to back away and want to kind of pass on the baton or pass on the power of what happens in our spiritual life to this kind of realm that feels non-emotional, which is pretty incompatible with the philosophy, because the more and more that we develop spiritually, according to our philosophy, the more and more attuned we are supposed to be to our spiritual emotions. So it doesn't make sense. And I know, Padmanabha Swami talks about this often in his talks. How could we have an experience in the world of spirit that we've been entirely avoiding in the world of matter, right? How could we have this huge, diverse, rich, profound emotional experience in the world of spirit and have as little contact as possible with emotions in our current embodied state? We have to somehow train. We have to somehow understand even the nuances of rasa. And this is my perspective on a personal level. The nuances of rasa are inaccessible to us so long as we don't purify ourselves and also have some skill in the domain of emotions. Because even the description, even the language that we're reading in Shastra to help us understand these pastimes in an attempt to purify ourselves, we won't actually know what they're talking about, even in a language way, if we don't have some familiarity, some felt sense of what an emotion is. That's why the Bhagavad Gita is so amazing, because as soon as you hear that Arjuna is experiencing anguish or despair, you can relate to it instantaneously. Who hasn't felt anguish? Who hasn't felt despair? Right? We might not have felt it about a fratricide that involves us like it does for him, but in our life, we can definitely feel, oh my God, I know what that's like. I know what it's like to be quivering and to feel like I, metaphorically, I'm dropping my bow and I'm just like, oh, I can't do this. So, to the extent that we're able to understand the language, we can start to purify ourselves by understanding the lila, by understanding the experience, the emotional experience, to the extent that we can. But there's also a range that we can, even in our embodied state. So the idea is to reach the topmost range, right? The greatest range of being able to understand and experience these emotions. So I think that part of this falls under the category. In the Gita also, Krishna says, Kshetragya means to be the knower of the field. The ultimate knower of the field is Krishna, right? Because he's in our hearts. He knows everything about our experience. But the knower of the field includes our bodies. It includes our minds, right? It includes everything about our journey. But especially now in the human experience, it can really be kind of whittled down to this experience of humanity, and humanity including our emotions, our mind, our words, our actions, and our relationships. So I wanted to kind of point all of that out to kind of start to bond really the emotional world and the spiritual world, and actually why it's important, why it's even important, why it's even relevant. So how do we do it, right? So When we experience an emotion, like we said, we want to think of it as kind of an extra sense, just like your sense of sight, your sense of sound, your sense of touch or taste or smell. It's a way of interfacing and understanding the world. It's a way also the world understands me because the emotions are coming through me. So what happens when anything takes place in the external world? It creates a stimulus, and that stimulus has an emotional effect. That emotional effect on a physiological level, if you look at just the chemistry and what happens in your brain and what happens in your physiology, the response to a stimulus in the emotional world, neuroscientists have found that it lasts about 90 seconds. Any given emotion lasts about 90 seconds. Everything after those 90 seconds seems to be related to whatever narrative we attach to that emotion. Now, this can happen completely due to our subconscious, where we just experience something and then it's just the momentum of our accumulated past experiences, our conditioning, our upbringing, so on, where the narrative is created for us, by our subconscious mind. Or we can decide to onboard our spiritual knowledge, our desire for kind of greater understanding the tool of the mind and the heart, all of our resources, and say, I'm actually going to co-create a narrative here with whatever's happening in my world. And I'm going to use that with as precise language as I have access to. So one thing that I find super helpful, and I sent this to Bhakti Rasa just this morning in the chat, and anyone who's worked with me probably has access to this, but I use this really great tool called the emotions wheel. And it's this kind of colorful wheel that goes from very broad emotions in the center, like happy, sad, mad, whatever. And then it opens up into very precise, more specific emotions. Some of those emotions have a lot of nuance between one and the other, right? So there'll be like the difference between feeling appreciative and feeling nostalgic, right? Those are under the greater, maybe, umbrella of love or feeling loving, but it has a little bit of nuance there, right? And because emotions are highly personal, it's really helpful to look at words that describe emotions and see, well, what does that mean for me? What's the nuance there for me, right? One example that Brené Brown gives in her work is the difference between awe and wonder, right? These are things that we may experience in our spiritual life, right? I might go to the temple on a festival day and sit in front of the deities, you know, they open the curtains and I'm struck by something, right? Some emotion kind of like washes over me and I'm like, what is that feeling? So initially, my response might be wow, but what is that wow? If I was going to get real granular, and that's why she says emotional granularity, if I was going to get granular and really want to savor that experience, download that experience, allow that experience to really take root in my body, in my mind, if I really wanted that impression, that samskara to land and to benefit me spiritually, I should describe it. I should describe it, and I should describe it as precisely as possible. So she gives the difference between awe and wonder. So awe is when you're kind of struck by something, and there's a very present sense of something is greater than me. And I'm observing something, and I'm being taken in by an experience of feeling like I'm a part of something, and that something is greater than all of us. So that's awe. And wonder has this unique kind of little hallmark, which is I'm curious about something. I want to know more, right? So awe might be like, wow, the altar looks spectacular today. And I'm just totally mesmerized by how God and goddess could be so gorgeous. That might be awe. But then I think, how is it possible that she's like kind of holding her hand in this way? And it seems like a little tilted. Like, I wonder what that body like. So that's wonder then. It's awe mixed with some sort of question, right? Some leaning in where I want to know more. Now, when I say I was struck with wonder seeing the altar, there's an action step attached to that, right? So now how I'm interfacing, how I'm reacting to that emotion has more subsequent steps that take place, right? Whereas awe, I might just rest there and go, wow. And then express to a good friend, like, I was awestruck by the deities today. And then allowing myself to kind of just bask and maybe feeling a little speechless about it and being able to say, like, there's nothing even to be done. I just am in awe. So all of these experiences that we describe, they have a subsequent fallout of what happens to you once you know, like, oh, that's the experience that I had. That's the emotion that I was experiencing. Now that's in this beautiful, you know, like I've seen the altar. So if we get down to brass tacks and we talk about like, okay, well, what happens in my relationships and especially relationships with other devotees? It is equally important to be granular in our description of what is happening emotionally for us, right? When we come across friction in whatever ashram we may be operating in. For example, I operate in the Grihastha ashram. I've been married, I've been with my husband for 15 years, I have 2 kids. It's super important for me to be precise in what it is I'm expressing, because we have to do things about my emotions, about his emotions, and about our kids' emotions, right? Especially in terms of bonding with children, right? Attachment theory, which is, you know, this incredible body of work that talks about how the earliest experiences, like in the womb of children, determine their emotional, psychological, even physiological and health development throughout the course of the rest of their lives, and is based on the safety of the bond that's created between caregivers and children, specifically mothers and children, but in general, caregivers and children. And one of the things that they found is that if there is not a climate of emotional safety, emotional contact, that if those emotional bonds are not well met, right, and well mirrored, then that child's development will be stunted, has a huge chance of being problematic in the future and then impacting other relationships around it, right? When kids are born, they're born pre-verbal. They're just emoting. They're just little energy bodies of emotions. And a sage adult would not just be able to receive those emotions, but would be able to mirror them. But I'm going to have a really hard time mirroring them, witnessing, validating those emotions if I don't know what they are, if I don't allow those emotions in my own self. So even for the sake of raising healthy next generation devotees, we need to be able to have a thriving, well fleshed out, well languaged emotional life so that we can offer them a mirror in which they see themselves and they go, oh, I'm not feeling disappointed. I'm frustrated. If I'm frustrated, it means I want something or I'm trying to do something and I haven't figured it out. Maybe I need help rather than giving up. That simple of a turn, right? Being mirrored by an adult, that precision, that self-understanding could be life-changing for a child. Could be life-changing for a child, and it's certainly life-changing for us as well. So when we come up with the issues that naturally arise, the tensions that naturally arise, conflicts, disagreements, misunderstandings, if we are emotionally fluent, if we know what to call what's happening to me, and I know how to process what you're telling me is happening to you, we'll have a better chance of understanding each other, right? Even in terms of emotional exchange, in terms in between devotees, there's the principle of Guhyam Akyati Prichati, right, from the Nectar of Instruction, where I'm able to reveal my mind in confidence, and I'm able to also listen confidentially to someone else's revealing their mind. To the extent that I'm able to do that precisely, then we'll be able to bond further. We'll be able to bond further. The bond is stronger because we're able to go to deeper and deeper levels. It becomes very surface when everything is categorized according to mad, sad, glad, or, you know, our broader categories. And there's also a sense of trust and safety in navigating a little bit of nuanced relationships because we know what we're talking about. We know what we're talking about. That language creates an experience. That experience is something that's validated by another, and so on. And I don't want to leave out the piece of being embodied, of actually allowing that emotion to inhabit your body. Each emotion has like a concurrent corresponding experience in the body. And so a lot of emotional safety is allowing your body to express that emotion in a healthy, unharmful way and realize that that's part of completing the cycle of that emotion. Part of completing the cycle of that emotion is creating enough safety in our communities for people to emote safely, right? And that can only be done if people are aware of their own emotions. You can only hold space for someone else's emotional experience to the extent that you understand and validate and hold space for your own. So, you know, these are the kind of premises that I'm considering in terms of the health of our relationships and spiritual communities. These are some of the topics that I think need to be explored. And also, I think that we need to have permission to start languaging our experience beyond maybe the language that our acharyas have given, beyond the language that may be used in certain literature according to a certain time and place, because there may be greater nuance that we might find useful, just like there's different ingredients. You know, I don't know of any like recipes, let's say traditionally, that used quinoa. But here we are in our temples, and in as far as it is useful and tasty and beautiful and something that we'd like to make an offering to the deities and to the devotees, sometimes we make preparations with quinoa. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. So if there are words that we haven't maybe used so much because they were unfamiliar, because they weren't described, because we were speaking a different language, and we find that it's useful and something that we can offer and that helps us understand ourselves and other devotees more, I would definitely want to use those words. So I think that having a vast emotional vocabulary and practicing, even if that practice is clumsy, which it will be, it is clumsy. It is clumsy to try and use new words to describe your experience. But what happens is you're using new words, and so you're opening some space to create a new experience through your language. It's the power of language, it's the tool of language. And I think that that's really, really powerful. I think that it could be very helpful in our spiritual life. And I think that it's something that Krishna has given us as the marriage between our embodied experience, our emotions, and our intelligence. Choosing to language your emotions and be precise with that, that's, onboarding the skill of the intelligence. It's the marriage of kind of the subtle body and the spirit soul trying to do its best with the technology that it's been given. And I think that it has the natural consequence, the natural benefit of being able to read pastimes and understand personalities with greater depth, because we are able to enter a realm of more emotional richness in the way that we understand Leela, in the way that we understand Rasa, in the way that we understand the descriptions of Krishna's beauty, of Radharani's beauty, of like really being able to have a more, multi-dimensional understanding of the emotional world in our embodied way, and also, in the kind of highest, most spiritual environment as well. So I hope that that is helpful. I know we kind of went across the spectrum, and I think that this is a very vast area for understanding. I think it's something that we're still kind of learning. I think it's something that we're exploring in our spiritual lives and in our spiritual community. But I would be really curious to hear any questions, any feedback, any comments about this topic, because I think that, in conversation, it becomes all the more interesting and relevant. So if anybody wants to,
Yeah.
Hari Bol, so nice to see
Hare
you.
Krishna. Very nice to see you. Thank you for breaking that down in such a beautiful way and pulling in our scriptures and helping us to understand that emotional life is not separate from our spiritual life. It's a part of it. You touched on some of the emotions, but I think in particular, one of the ones that devotees find the most challenging is the emotion of anger. And so I was wondering if you could unpack that a little bit for us to show how it, instead of valencing it, and how it, what's its purpose, and how to use it and understand it, and not have this kind of like knee-jerk reaction that if anybody has anger, they're not a spiritualist or there's something defective about them. And just broaden that particular emotion for us.
Thank you. Yeah, that's such a it's such an important topic. Also, I want to say that Janaki Prabhu could be giving this workshop and answering that question much better than I can. So she's just teeing me up, but her expertise far surpasses my own. So I just wanted to put that out there as a disclaimer. Yeah, I think that that's it's actually kind of a universal thing. I think that most people are quite uncomfortable with anger. I think most people are quite uncomfortable with anger. And then some of the people that we see are most comfortable with anger are using it disproportionately and can sometimes enter the realm of like aggression and violence. It's like almost too comfortable with anger and it's becoming something else. And I would venture that, in the Gita, actually, I don't remember when I did this, but I remember somebody mentioning this and I went back and double checked it, that the obstacle that Krishna describes as most difficult for the spiritual seeker in the Bhagavad Gita, in terms of numerical times mentioned, is anger. More than lust, more than greed, more than ignorance is anger. And I don't know if that's just a translation thing, if it's a linguistic thing. I think that it's fair to consider how harmful anger can be if processed improperly. If processed improperly. So I think that kind of what you were saying before, what we were speaking about earlier about valencing an emotion and saying, well, this is not good, this is good, this is not good. I think that anger is such powerful medicine because anger is alerting us very quickly to something that is not okay. The medicine of anger is the violation of a boundary being called attention to. Something is not okay. There's some lack of alignment, something is off. And anger is our emotional body coming online to let us know that in a way that creates a high alert. Now, I think that anger is such a hot, fast emotion. Like, even when you become angry, your body temperature rises, you might flush, you might feel like shaky. It's such a kinetic emotion. It generates so much energy. I think that anger is asking for action, but I don't necessarily think that you need to act out the anger, if that makes sense. I know that there's like some linguistic thing that's happening there. The anger itself is considered to be a catalyst, but it's not meant to be what the action should be itself. It's not meant to be acted out. It's supposed to call your attention to something. And it's a very, very hot, high alert kind of emotion. So if something is really out of alignment, somebody said something that really hurt me, my anger is supposed to say, hey, that's not okay. I didn't like how that felt at all. That really hurt my feelings. And then, okay, so what are we going to do about this? Now, what are we going to do about this? The answer is not necessarily you need to go act this anger out, express this anger to this person, make sure that they are now, because actually what's happening is the anger is so much that I'm kind of trying to pass it off like a hot potato to the other person. Now you have to help me carry this anger. You have to see this anger. Now you're responsible for this anger. In a way, we're so scared of our own anger. We're so uncomfortable with our own anger that we immediately need somebody else to share it. And so we call them in to our experience of anger because it's almost too much for us. Now, if I knew that I could handle anger and that I was digesting anger and that it was good medicine that was helping me call attention to something that really matters to me, right? Anger means something really matters to me. Maybe this relationship really matters to me. Maybe how I feel about myself really matters to me. Not being misunderstood, trying to be seen as, doing my best, or that person's opinion. Maybe that person's opinion really matters to me. If I'm able to sit with that feeling and expand to the capacity of holding those fiery emotions, then I can start to say, okay, what really mattered to me there? What was the line that was crossed, right? And so sometimes in that Language of Emotions book, the author talks about, you can ask emotions certain questions. Brené Brown talks about this as well. What's the question you could ask that emotion? Not that person, that emotion. What was the line that was crossed? What was something that wasn't okay with you? What felt out of integrity, right? What felt hurtful? What? And then based on that, you can onboard another emotion to come and assist with the transmission of that energy. You can say, I feel angry. I feel angry. Not, I'm trying not to feel this anger. So I'm going to pass it on to you and vent it out by yelling at you or throw something. That's me trying to get rid of my anger because I'm actually terrified of my anger. I can't handle it. I'm overwhelmed by my anger. I can't do it. So I'm trying to get rid of it. So anytime that anger gets out of hand, I think that it can become toxic. And it's because we're not exactly sure what to do with it. It's so much energy. Our emotional body is so powerful that we're actually desperately trying to get rid of it, even by means of like harming another person, so that now we enter into another emotion, right? Maybe now I feel guilty. Maybe now I feel resentful. Maybe those emotions feel safer for me than pure anger in its purest form. So I'm kind of trying to like sidetrack us into another thing because that's easier for me to deal with. Now I feel disappointed that I yelled at you. Well, disappointment's a more comfortable feeling for me. Maybe I grew up feeling a little disappointed in myself, and that's familiar. And that's why I go there after, right? So there's all kinds of kind of patterns that go along with these different emotions. If maybe as a child, somebody didn't look at me when I was angry because my sister took my toy or my brother hit me and I got really angry, and an adult didn't look at me and go, ooh, you're so angry. You didn't like that at all. You didn't like the way that person treated your body. You didn't like the way that person snatched your toy. That wasn't okay. You didn't like that. Your body said, I don't like that. And that's how you got angry. Right? As soon as you language it and as soon as you validate, like, yeah, that's what happened there. And then it kind of neutralizes the experience. Like, okay, all right, I didn't like that. So now what can I do about this? So I think that, spiritually, there's a little bit of a desire to, maybe not a little bit, maybe a lot of it, to tamp down that anger because culturally, societally, and in our spiritual life, we haven't really been given tools with what to do with the anger. Where did that anger come from? Right? How do you handle that? Can you create space for it? Is it dangerous? Is it unhelpful? So, I think that that's some context for it. I think that, each case would be very individual and how what anger looks like, the story of your anger. What does anger look like for you? What does anger mean for you? Anger can sometimes also be kind of a broad category where you can like further, like, oh, I'm not angry. I'm actually feeling insecure and that insecurity. So the more you kind of fine-tune, like, what does the anger, where did the anger come from? What's the story behind that anger? What is that anger calling you to do? Right. I think that that would be interesting. And you know, because we're personal, because we're trying to be personal about a personal philosophy, anger might look really different for me than it looks for my husband, than it looks for my child or my friend or someone else in my community. So, you know, holding space for how anger moves through each person, I think, could be a really great field of learning for all of us as well. But I think it has more to do with that, which is discomfort with unfamiliar emotions or emotions that are considered anarthas in the sense that insofar as we're unable to digest them and embody them properly, they will be a huge hindrance because they're just so much energy that they'll totally like sidetrack and block anything that we're trying to do. So yeah, I don't know if that was helpful, but that's what came to mind. Thank you so much. Yeah, back to Yasa.
Yeah, in what Janaki was speaking about, and you, I was thinking that fear could be an element of anger, since if anger is when our boundaries are crossed, you know, if you think about somebody penetrating across your boundary, that usually invokes fear. So then from fear, the way to counteract fear is to make ourselves more powerful. So the power of the storm, the power of anger, is to combat, you know, a supposed enemy or something that crossed our boundaries. So
Yeah.
that force, that power, like a storm.
Totally. Yeah, I'm trying to keep myself safe. And I think that that's, again, it's the emotional body trying to be your ally, right? It's a perceived breach in safety. And so my anger is coming to help me. It's what my emotions think needs to happen to keep me safe. So again, that element of gratitude of like, whoa, thanks. Like, maybe there's something I need to do about this and it's not lashing out, but I can see that my emotional body, my subtle body is trying to help me. It's trying to help me because I'm perceiving not feeling safe. And I like what you said about, you know, yeah, if there's like a violation of a boundary, then I'm going to try and keep myself safe, defend myself against a perceived enemy. And this is why I think that it gets tricky in devotional life. Because we're supposed to be trying very hard to not see anyone as our enemy. And so anger puts that in that kind of polarity of like enemies and allies. So it's understanding anger and saying, okay, I feel angry, and that doesn't mean that that person is an enemy. But I should do something because this is catalyzing energy. This is energy that creates motion. It's kinetic. It's actually stimulating my body to do something. Now, what I do, that shouldn't be informed by my spiritual values, actually. It's not something that I'm meant to, you know, just kind of like fire off. I see something in the chat. Okay, so Janaki Prabhu said, this is one of my favorite quotes about emotions. Kerwin Ray says, emotions are like children. We don't want them driving the car, but we don't want to shove them in the trunk either. Thank you for sharing that. Yeah. And I think, you know, I've used that metaphor in my work with people before, which is, you know, welcome them. Welcome them. They might just be a hitchhiker who's in the car for some time and they'll get out in their time. But there's no need to reject them. They can just hitch a ride, you know, and the self is the driver, the spiritual self is the driver. And I think that that's helpful, you know. We don't want them in the trunk, of course. We want them like strapped in, safely strapped in. All right. Yeah. Any other kind of thoughts or comments, any emotion that feels particularly mysterious or difficult or easy, maybe anything that kind of comes to mind that might be relevant to our conversation.
One thing I was thinking of just now is that when we try to shove these emotions down, they prevent us from having any emotions. Like if we're trying to shove down anger, we're trying to shove down sadness, we can't discriminate on that. We have to shove down all emotions. So if we if we don't allow everything to show up and experience it, then those things that we valence and think are positive, we can't even experience them because we've tamped them all down in the process of doing it. And so I do, just so much of, whether it's just that one anger, if our whole focus is trying to tamp down the anger, then we're tamping down everything else too. So it's really important to understand what these emotions are. And I've studied the work of Carla McLaren, the one you've been quoting from The Language of Emotions. And there's so much in there, so many gifts that we're missing when we don't explore these things. And it's just like looking generationally, like how our, as we go on in our society, where we could be where that value of not expressing these emotions gets cultivated, then our children get stunted too, and we're passing this along. And it's really important for us to shift that culture as the adults, and so that the children see the examples of how one does that. This morning I saw a quote about if you see a behavior, try to understand what the feeling is underneath it, but underneath the feeling, trying to understand what the need is that's not being met. And so often we're responding to a behavior without going through the next two steps. And when we meet the needs, then those emotions can calm down because the emotions are getting created because a need isn't being met.
Yeah, thank you so much. I think that that's such valuable, information that the emotions are pointing to something, and that something is part of that person's personhood, right? It's addressing the actual self, as in as much as they're knowing themselves, that is going to kind of express itself. And I think that kind of enters the realm of personal responsibility, which is, if I'm following that sequence of like the emotions are, ultimately pointing to a need, what are my emotions pointing at? Right, I'm feeling things as I'm feeling them. Am I able to trace those back and realize I don't need my emotions to do all my work for me? Right, I want to be able to maybe be conscious, be aware of my needs, and say, oh, well, when I felt frustrated, it's because I needed help. Right, and then taking a look and saying, did I ask for help? What's happening there? Right, so just realizing, like, oh, that's where the realm of my personal work is. Because my emotions are not just something that I'm meant to use as communication to others. It's also really valuable data for myself. And, what you were saying about, modeling what that's like for our children and allowing the validity, right, of emotions to exist independent of their kind of like social or societal desirability. That's so important, especially because that's not a totally disinterested realm, right? Like one of the things that, I think it was Brené Brown was talking about. She was saying that in her research, she found that our vocabulary for negative emotions, quote unquote, negative emotions, is way more expansive than our vocabulary for our positive emotions. It was like, I'm happy, I'm good, I'm fine, I'm excited, I'm great, right? Great's not even an emotion, but these specific emotions that are, it's because positive emotions are perhaps even more nuanced, right? And maybe they're not hot and spicy and fiery and calling my attention. And so I don't even take the time to really parse out, like, what exactly was it? What exactly was it that I was feeling in that positive way? So she was saying that there's so much room for work there because we don't even know how to describe when things are positive for us, what to speak of, when things are not working out in our favor, when we're having some sort of issue, and how, yeah, you can't compartmentalize it. You can't say, well, I only want to experience these emotions, but I don't really want to experience these emotions, and these are not good for my spiritual life, and these are great for my spiritual life. And it's basically saying, no, if you dull the sensitivity of your emotional world, you're dulling everything. You're dulling everything, and that's going to be to the detriment of your relationships and also your self-understanding, because there's going to be, again, the limits of my language or the limits of my world. If I can't contact what I'm feeling, I'm not going to describe what I'm feeling. And if I don't describe what I'm feeling, then my world is shrinking. It's becoming very, very limited. And you see that there's a dullness and a numbness in my emotional world. And that doesn't not have consequences in the body. That doesn't not have consequences in the body. People become physically ill from the stagnation of emotions. unexpressed emotions, uncontacted emotions. It's not even that someone is conscious and they're trying not to express it because they don't want to out of shame, and that happens. But even just like total invalidation of the emotional world. And then what does the body do? Because the body's still trying to be your ally. Your body's going to try and express that emotion on a cellular level. So even if we just consider our physical health, it behooves us to kind of let these emotions flow and let them have their place, because all of that is interconnected. And you see people that are ill and how it has roots in trauma and roots in their, you know, the family of origin and what their life was like there. You know, there's so much literature and research coming out now about how, yeah, it impacts everything. It impacts everything. So having that, you know, knowing that all those pieces are interconnected, that we're this universe of kind of things that are threaded together, and acknowledging that and using that to our advantage rather than trying to, you know, kind of compartmentalize, which is sort of what we're taught.
Yeah, I really appreciate what you all are saying, and I really agree with it. And it seems to me that emotions are like a language of their own, and then we are kind of like translators. So as you speak of language, we don't have the language. So we need to learn the language that we can properly translate what the emotions are trying to say to us, because they in and of themselves are language that supersedes even words, although we need the words to be able to describe our experiences. So we're kind of just like a translator of what does this emotion mean? What's it trying to say? What is it saying?
Yeah, that's such a cool way of thinking about it. That's such a cool way of thinking about it. And it speaks to how emotions have their own intelligence, right? Just like the little white blood cells in my body, or the little skin cells, or the little neurons,
exactly.
Like they have their own intelligence. Like I'm not doing the work for them. They have their own, and that's the amazingness of, you know, Krishna being in everything, is that it gives it that intelligence inherently. And so the emotions are like that too. They have their own intelligence. They have their own wisdom. And our job is actually just to pay attention and to interpret accurately, right? And a lot of times that happens. That's why it's so important to link body work to emotions work, is that a lot of times my understanding of an emotion is going to need to start at the body level. What is happening to me right now? Before I say like, I'm feeling overwhelmed, or I'm feeling frustrated, or I'm feeling disappointed, like, if I notice like, oh, my shoulders have kind of collapsed and caved in, and I feel kind of like protective of my like heart area, and I feel kind of like tears coming to my eyes, and I feel like kind of low motivation, and everything just kind of feels like soft and kind of shy, and I'm a little gloomy, and it's like, maybe this is what I'm like when I'm disappointed. So a lot of times it's like my body will start to give me cues of like, this is what you're feeling. This is what you could be feeling. This is the family of feelings you might be in right now. And, you know, that's how Brené Brown in her book, Atlas of the Heart, which I really recommend, it's such an excellent book. She groups according to the experience, you know, things we do when we are happy, or ways that we feel when we're having a hard time, or, you know, whatever. And so she groups it according to kind of the experiential family that it's in. And that's really helpful, because then it starts to kind of create some discernment. You're able to kind of fine tune according to what that initial kind of impression was. And a lot of times it starts in the body, and the body itself can help you flush out that emotion and deal with that emotion. So I think it's all, you know, very much interconnected.
Yeah, that's so cool. And like, again, about alerting, you know, it's like the things that happen on the physical level, like say you have a pain, so a physical pain, so that physical pain is letting you know there's something wrong here. You need to actually look at it. You need to address it. So these emotions that come up, they're alerting us. There's something amiss. There's something going on that you need to pay attention to. And it, like you brought up children, Janaki, I see sometimes that emotions are like children. If you ignore them, they start off like at one level, but then they get louder and louder. The more you ignore them, the louder they have to get to be able to get attention. So it ends up escalating. And sometimes then we can't pinpoint what that emotion is trying to say, because it has had to scream so loudly for so long until we took a look at it. Yeah, the connection between the body and emotions is really cool. Amazing
Yeah,
system.
And sometimes in the process of trying to like shut that child up, the emotion gets the message of like, no one's coming for you. No one's going to pay attention to you. And so it kind of collapses in on itself. And a lot of times depression or anxiety or these complexes of stuckness is just unemotion or several emotions that have just been like neglected or shamed and have kind of collapsed onto themselves. And so a lot of the work of therapy or group work or, you know, personal development is kind of first unpacking like, what is it that just like never got my attention? Like, it either wasn't safe to express in the first place, so it was just kind of shut down, or it just, you know, the emotional body also is it finite because it's a material resource at the end of the day. And so just like our body can only work up until a certain point where our adrenals are shot, or, you know, we've like maxed out our cortisol, whatever, and the body just kind of shuts down. The same thing happens in our emotional world. And you can experience emotional exhaustion where it's just like the body to protect itself or the mind to protect itself will simply like pack it up and just not give access to these places until it finds a requisite safety that will allow it to. And usually that comes with some sort of support. Usually that safety has to kind of be built for us, constructed for us. And then in that relationship, and that's why relationships are so important. Sometimes I'm not able to fully understand an emotion, even if it's flowing in a healthy way. Sometimes I'm really not able to understand all dimensions of an emotion until I enter in relationship and I start seeing it from different angles. And if it's an emotion that never got my attention and had to scream super loud, or if it's an emotion that screams so loud that it got exhausted and collapsed on itself, then I'm going to need somebody else to help me rebuild my trust and rebuild safety in such a way that I can even take a look at that, because it's probably not going to feel safe. And again, it's just my body trying to protect itself. It's not an infinite, you know, source of energy. And so to protect that energy kind of, you know, wellspring, it just goes, no, like we can't do that emotion. So I think that that's the importance also of relationships, is knowing that everybody's coming into this life and our spiritual communities with all kinds of experiences in our background, all kinds of experiences in our past life, what to speak of past life, but in this life, you know, all kinds of different upbringings. All, you know, we really are like international societies of spiritual practitioners. And we're all trying to become Krishna conscious. We're all trying to work towards this common goal. But the process of getting there is going to be completely unique. And it's going to be colored by our upbringing. It's going to be colored by early life experiences and all of our relationships leading up to that and through that. And I think that a beautiful thing that we can offer to people coming into our spiritual communities is these are people who are trying to have a well-integrated spiritual life. They are using their emotional resources to do spiritual work. They're using their mental resources, their financial resources, their agricultural resources, you know, like really just like bring everything in and use it with that same principle of Yukta Vairagya, knowing that there's nothing that, you know, we can use everything in Krishna service except for emotions, because anger is not good and it's toxic and it just, you know, is a detriment to us. Wouldn't that be random? Wouldn't that be random that Krishna gives us so many things and this one thing he just doesn't want us to use that ingredient? It seems unlikely. Right? It seems unlikely. And there's even so many transcendental examples of how anger was used properly. You know, Prabhupada uses the example of Hanuman, for example. Right? Or, you know, Lord Chaitanya becoming angry when Nityananda Prabhu gets struck, you know, and he calls in Sudarshan Chakra. There's so many examples of what transcendental. So does that mean that there's not an analogous version of anger where we sense that something is not okay and we're supposed to use that as information and fuel to make a proper decision or express ourselves or whatever? So I think that it could be really powerful to offer people who are seeking, who are suffering, who are struggling, who they themselves are maybe unfamiliar with the emotional world and how useful and beautiful that could be, to offer them a space of like, hey, we're doing this work here. We're doing this work here. We're like trying to figure it out also. We're also studying this. We're also trying to see, well, how do I use this here? Because I want to use everything I have here, right? I want to bring all of me into my spiritual world. You know, just like Janaki Prabhu was saying, like, you can't compartmentalize. Yeah, you can't do that with your spiritual life either. There's like a real danger in saying, this is my spiritual life and this is my material life, right? And so I want to bring all of me into my spiritual life, and that includes my emotions. And I think that there's room for prayer there. You know, I think that there's room for us to like genuinely pray and you know, ask Radhakrishna, I don't know what to do with this emotion. I want to understand this emotion, but I don't want to be afraid of this emotion and shame myself and hide this in the shadow and let this be untouchable by you. Let this be unofferable to you. Right? I actually want to use this in some way. I want to be able to offer this to you. I understand that this is information. I understand that this is energy. Show me, right? So asking, in the proper like alignment of Sambandha, it's knowing that we're always going to be connected to divinity in any point in our, human experience. So asking them to accompany us, not keeping them separate, diverted from our emotional experience, like it's something that's kind of like untouchable or dirty or mundane. It's basically saying, no, I want to purify this, like guide me with this. And so making it really real and bringing it into your spiritual life, even just by way of prayer. I don't understand anger. I don't understand greed. I don't know, whatever it is. Krishna, please help me. I want to understand how can I use this? I don't want to just evaporate it. I want to make it useful, but show me how. What is it that I'm meant to see here? And I think that that's a way in which we, go not just conscious, but Krishna conscious. Like, how do we do this as a partnership? Yeah, I see you have your hand
Yeah,
raised,
that's
Bhakti.
so. Yeah, that's so beautiful and really important when we're trying to understand this unconditional love. Because if we don't actually allow ourselves to bring all that stuff we don't want anybody to see, if we don't actually bring that into our relationship, then we won't be able to actually believe that we are unconditionally loved. If we don't put everything on the table, if we stuff something aside, we can always keep that in our mind saying, oh, but if they knew this, then they wouldn't love me. If Krishna knew this or my friends knew that, then they wouldn't love me. So it allows us to keep a distance from experiencing unconditional love. But if we are able to come in raw moments and with that internal nakedness and show all of our emotions, and yes, as you're saying so wonderfully in prayer, please help me understand this. What do I need to learn from this so that I can come closer to you? Then that's, I think that's so valuable.
Yeah, definitely. It speaks to like true intimacy in spiritual relationships, It's like really actually being known and knowing another, right? People can walk through this life, even in a spiritual community, even doing service together, and feel entirely unknown, right? Or feel like they don't know someone else. And it's because of that, what you're sharing of like, yeah, there's like raw parts of us and and I think that part of that is also humility, the humility of realizing like this emotion is intense and I don't exactly know what to do with it, and to know that that's not counter to spiritual development. I think it's a symptom of spiritual development because to the degree that you advance spiritually, there's supposed to be a corresponding humility that also increases. Right? An awareness of all that we don't know, an awareness of all the space that we have to grow, and all the things that we could offer that we didn't realize were offerable before. I didn't realize anger was offerable before, and now I realize it's very rich with things that I can offer. And I didn't know this was, I had access to pray about this, or I could bring this into my relationship. So it's like suddenly shedding light. I'm like, oh my God, look at all these resources, like suddenly I found this like treasure box of things, and it's okay and appropriately humble to be like, I don't know how to do it. I don't know how to do this, but I'm gonna try out of trust and out of a desire to, yeah, be able to expose all of myself in an honest and genuine way. Krishna already knows even the things that we're not even consciously aware of because that's who he is, And so that's when we say Kshetrajna, like he's the Kshetrajna, like capital K, capital J, like he's the one who knows the stuff. So he's already the knower of the field, but we are also responsible for being knowers of our field to the extent that we can. And shunning that responsibility doesn't inherently make us more spiritual. In fact, like you're saying, it can be a huge obstacle to true intimacy in spiritual relationships, real vulnerable relationships. And on some subtle level, I feel like we can sense it. We can sense like, this connection is not all levels deep. And it's because I'm not bringing all of myself, or I don't sense that this other person trusts me enough to kind of fully open themselves up to us. And this is a something that I've heard many people speak about. in our spiritual community, which is like it doesn't feel like it goes all levels deep. We're talking about the highest thing, the most sublime thing, the ultimate goal, the ultimate environment, but there's some depth there that I'm like really longing for. And I think that this is the realm of where it happens. And it's allowing ourselves to kind of, yeah, work with those really, primal base, tools and materials that are given to us from childhood, and realize like, yeah, this is also part of the work. This is actually what's going to make my relationships rich. It's what's going to make me real. It's what's going to make me like 3D, actually. It makes me a fully embodied human being. And then that gives me access to vitality, to energy, as once I have all those like valves open, like access to all those emotions, that's what emotions are. Emotions are energy. So then I have energy for life. I have energy for seva. I have energy for relationships. I have energy for inquiring, for reading, for all of a sudden I tap into this like wellspring of like, oh yeah, energy. There's like the mantra of the modern person. It's like, I'm so tired. I'm tired. I'm tired. I'm tired. It's like, yeah, but your emotions are raw fuel. And if we're not tapping into that, we're not using that properly, we're not embodying it, then like you're gonna be tired. I'm gonna be tired. So I think that, even for the sake of powering our service, realizing like, yeah, you gotta open up all those valves and allow that energy to like really flow, let it to really inhabit you and let it power you, allowing it to be a source of power, along with that corresponding humility of like, well, I don't know how to do this, but we're gonna figure this out in relationship and, with each other.
And proof of what you're saying is like depression, because that's like the ultimate repression of emotions, repressing all emotions. And that's when you're tired, when you're depressed, you're absolutely tired, exhausted. So yeah, holding in all of those emotions takes a lot of energy. So that's kind of proof to what you're saying. Depression.
And you can't be, depressed emotionally and then like thriving in your spiritual life. It's very difficult because, again, yeah, like what you're saying, like imagine how much energy it takes to to hold all those emotions down. It's like energy just leaking, leaking, leaking. Then illness comes, your physical body suffers from that, and yeah, you can't relate to devotees. And coming back to this quote that I shared of Prabhupada's from the Gita, like he's not saying that these people are fake Krishna consciousness. Often withdraws to a secluded place to become fully Krishna conscious by chanting the holy name of Krishna. He's not saying that you're not becoming Krishna conscious. He's just saying that that's not what we're meant to do. That's not our path. It's not our work, right? He wanted to skillfully avoid the fighting by using Krishna consciousness as an excuse. And one of the things that I found was really helpful is that, later on in the Gita in chapter 8, right, he says, you should think of me in the form of Krishna and at the same time carry out your prescribed duty of fighting. With your activities dedicated to me and your mind and intelligence fixed on me, you will attain me without doubt. In order for him to fight, it would be almost impossible for him not to channel a requisite level of anger at the injustice that was taking place, at the violations of so many laws and codes and ethics and morality. He needed to, right? And so that's Krishna was saying, like, yeah, if you become despondent and you become atrophied in your ability to act because you're morose and because you're in despair, you're lamenting, but like in the wrong way. Like that's not where you're supposed to be channeling that energy. We need to power you up. You need to go and fight. And so he's basically calling attention to like the entire history of what just happened and the fact that Krishna's already taking care of it. Even Krishna, in when he reveals the universal form, he's revealing quite a ferocious, Krishna is emoting on the most transcendental, pure, most elevated level possible. He's emoting a certain ferocity because he's trying to get a certain job done. And so his emotions match his actions. That's literally the kind of like the required components of rasa, is that everything matches. The emotion matches the situation, it matches the people that are there, it matches the context, it matches the mood, everything matches. It's like the perfect marriage, the perfect harmony of all the required components. We have to be like that too. How are we going to enter into any lila, into any rasa, if we ourselves don't really know how to operate congruently? So in our situation, does our energy match our context, match our role, match our situation, match our emotions, match our body, match, so being congruent, it sounds so simple, but it's actually such work, So in the same way, it's basically saying, he's asking Arjuna, think of me and do the fighting. That means probably, if I was going to just kind of enter in what I imagine a warrior needs to do, is to channel a requisite healthy anger at the violations and injustices that have taken place. And at the same time, think of Krishna. He's not saying do one or the other. He's saying do them both. So creating that dual track of I can emote and think of Krishna at the same time. That's what he's telling Arjuna to do. We're meant to use the Bhagavad Gita as a template of how to understand our work in this world. We have to be able to do both. And I think that sometimes because they feel like important work, we choose one or we choose the other. Well, I'm in my emotion, this is my material life, and I'm doing my emotional thing, or I don't want to do emotions at all, and I'm just focusing on my Krishna consciousness. And Krishna says, no, that's Prabhupada saying, no, that's an excuse. You have to actually do both. You have to do both. And if we are meant to do both, it means that our technology, our vessel, our human experience is expansive enough actually to hold both. That's a trust piece. That's a faith piece. Krishna's telling us that even if it's not our experience yet, because we haven't developed the skills to do it, he's saying that's how we're meant to do it. All right. So then, like, let's practice. Let's see if I can be angry and think of Krishna without one needing to cancel the other one out or any of these emotions. Can I feel joyful? Can I feel excited, scared, surprised, you know, whatever. This whole emotions wheel is so phenomenal because it gives us access to so many different words to describe our experience. And yeah, so can I do it while thinking of Krishna at the same time and allowing that to be actually something that is, you know, integrated rather than contradicting?
I think the key to what you were just saying is you said earlier, it's to consider that emotions are can be offered. It's part of service. That's how we can connect the two, is our emotions are part of our service because it's again about self-realization. Our emotions are speaking to us about something within ourselves that needs to be addressed or healed, and then that is free then to be offered in service.
Yeah, it's a real understanding of the tool that we've been given. You know, it's like having a car and just having this whole section of the car that you just like don't pay any attention to, but you're meant to drive this car to some destination. It's like, well, just what does that part of that car do? And it's like, oh, this allows me to use the windshield wiper so that when there's rain, it kind of scoots the rain. Oh, that makes sense, because then when it rains, then I can see better. It's like, yeah, well, you got to use it. So it's the same way, you know, if like we're meant to be using, we can't just like section off this whole part of our, you know, human technology that's meant to be offered. You know, it's part of the vehicle, it's part of the technology, it's part of the tool. And if it exists here, that means that there's some spiritual counterpart that we'll also be able to use, but not, you know, at the complete ignoring of that technology here in our embodied self. And it's just not going to work. We're not going to even be able to create loving, thriving, devotee communities, which is also part of our work as spiritualists. Like, we're just not going to have healthy relationships if we're not emoting in a healthy way. Anyways, that's what I have today. I appreciate so much this conversation, and I appreciate so much you all sharing your thoughts and your realizations. It makes the conversation so much more dynamic. And yeah, this is something that I'm learning about. I'm fascinated by. I'm also intimidated by it because I realize how, you know, big and deep the work can be. But yeah, I'm very grateful that the conversations are taking place. You know, I'm so thankful to Padmanabhaswamy for having this conversation available to be had, and for he himself, you know, often talking about this topic and sharing his realizations and how it ties to our spiritual life. And yeah, I think that it's a there's a very rich area of study and understanding here for devotees in our spiritual community. So I thank you so much for allowing me to explore this along with you.
Yeah, thank you so much for joining the platform and sharing what you know. And Janaki, thanks for sharing your knowledge and your inquiry. And Adrian, thanks for joining in. It's very valuable. And to me, being an older person, these kinds of things give me so much hope for the future, that the generational traumas will be able to be healed, and y'all will be able to pass on the beautiful gifts that come from the healing of those. So I appreciate you all on so many levels. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Arrival.